Okay, so in the interest of time, being able to eat before NEMA talks later, I'll try and go quick. So what I'm going to talk to you about is stuff we've been doing the last year, mostly these papers here. But don't worry, don't freak out. It's not going to be all these papers. And I decided to call this talk the Higgsine Investigation because I was talking to Heather about something you'll see. And she looked at me and she said something along the lines of, wow, it's like data forensics. And so it's kind of like that. It's what we've been doing a lot of the last year. And if you want to look and relate information you see to the individual papers, you can look back on these slides and they're online. Most of it is just the sort of fit stuff and some Suzy stuff. I'll show you a little bit with current data, something that'll probably just work its way into an appendix of our summer paper. And it's odd, but I'm putting this here, even though I intend to say nothing about it whatsoever. But I might get excited. And if I do, I figure they should get some credit if I spill the beans as to something that's upcoming. So anyways, we all got very excited in the summer. And I found this online. I just love this picture. So let me just tell you the story. My part of this excitement was I went in at 5 in the morning, believe it or not, to get in the damn room. So I don't know if anyone else was there. Went in at 5 in the morning, line as far as the eye can see. So walking past the line, did a quick mental count. I was 200 back in the line, 5 in the morning to get in the room. So I looked up online, how many seats are in the room? The answer is 400, okay? And so it's 5 in the morning, I already made the effort to come in, I'm gonna stand in the damn line. I didn't factor in two things. One is many, many people in the world have more power than me, and so there's 150 seats reserved for them. And then other people in the world really don't feel like they need to stand in line if other people stand in line. So we didn't get in. And I had to sit in the theory room with everybody else, but nevertheless, an exciting day. And now we get to have workshops like this to figure out what's going on here. And I do think that was my mental state and lots of people's mental state. And the DG said this great statement as a layman, he would say, I think we have it. And the only question is, what is it? And so now things have evolved. And now we've gone from that, and that it's part of our mental problems as theorists, but really, I think a lot of people are depressed. I'm not, but we still want to know what's going on there, but where's Suzy? So we'll talk a little bit about that at the end. But anyways, this is it in terms of up to the summer. This is pre-HCP data, and all I've done here is collected a bunch of signal strings just so you can see the visual scatter. So the top is the Tevatron, and then 7 ATV Atlas, 7 and ATV CMS. Atlas is at 126.5 because that's where they tell us subcategories, at least as of September, for the diphoton data, and CMS is at 125. So one thing you could just do, and could make this talk very, very short if we were all calm and collected theorists, would be just take these signal strengths and just do some naive combination of them to just more statistically ask the question, is it just like the standard model Higgs? We know some should be high, some should be low, so what you can do, and I'll show you formulas to do this, is just a naive Gaussian combination of these things. And what you'll get, you probably can't see it, but what you'll get, here's the standard model expectation. Is there something to point with? Other than my finger? This little pointer? This pointer? This looks like a pointer. Okay. Right. So right here, on 1 for the signal strengths, is normalized to the standard model. That's standard model expectation. It's a black line. And you probably can't see it, but there's a little green shaded region right around there. And that's what you get if you just do this naive Gaussian combination and combine all of these. It just looks a lot like a standard model Higgs. And the error goes down because you win because you're combining a lot of things. We're neglecting correlations here. But anyways, if we were just calm, rational people, we could just do that and just stop and wait for these things in time to converge if that's what's going to happen on the standard model case, and that could be the end of it. But you can actually get a lot of more information out if you do all sorts of tricks. And I'll show you some tricks so you can get some more information out at this time. So here's more on it, HCP data and last week. And you know that you're doing too much Higgs physics if you get really excited when you can use tau tau subcategories, and I am excited about that. But anyways, this is what we got, and that's the profile of it. So most of what you'll see in this talk corresponds to this data set, not including HCP, although I'll show you a little bit with this and some other things here. Stuff we just did on the weekend as we're working on this. So what is it? Well, we don't know. Is it a standard model Higgs? I don't know. Is it some gorgeous thing sitting on top of the standard model Higgs? I don't know. Could be a physics 2-for-1. We'll find out. But you have to assume something. So I'm assuming there's no bizarre interpretation. I'm going to assume a scalar field and do minimal bottom-up effective field theory is assuming a scalar field. Because you've got to assume. I'm not going to say anything about this, other than what I've said. So anyways, it's a scalar field that is being assumed here because, of course, the problem is trying to solve. We know that the problem is the massive Ws and Zs, and the scattering of them have this problem, bad high-energy behavior. And you know that you can worry about gauge invariance, but if you just think about it in terms of a nonlinear chiral electric Lagrangian, you can write this down as a leading term in that sort of theory, and just give mass of the Ws and Zs by hand. You have Goldstones from broken SE2 left, SE2 right, some vectorial subgroup. You put them in this exponential in the sigma field, and that's fine to give mass to the W and Z. And the gauge invariance gods won't strike you down. And there's a problem, of course. The theory is poorly behaved, as we know. And so we expected, it was pretty expected universally, that we'll find something that deals with this. And something that deals with this nicely is a scalar field. It's the simplest, stupidest thing you could put in, right? So if you wanted to be also on that list of pictures of people in the 60s, if you were smart enough to do this and knew the problems, you could just put in a scalar field with a general coupling. Don't be smart enough to do the whole standard model Higgs story, but just put in a scalar field with a general coupling to the W and Z, and then do all the diagrams, not just this one, put them all together, and you'll get that the bad high-energy behavior will get corrected with a term like this, and in a very particular case, which is a really good scalar, it'll cancel off this problem exactly. That's the standard model Higgs mechanism, when it cancels off all of the amplitudes that have all these trouble right away with just a particular choice of all the couplings. But we want to be able to distinguish a crappy scalar that just pushes up the cutoff scale of the theory, you know, maybe to a couple TeV higher. To give you an idea of scale, if you have couplings within 10% of the standard model, some crappy scalar in this sort of theory, you get up to about 7 TeV in cutoff scale. So we want to be able to distinguish those possibilities. And we want to have a general field theoretic formalism with which to interface with the Higgs data and really get the data to tell us that it's the standard model Higgs that it's selecting for, the beautiful scalar that solves these problems all at once. And so bottom up, I think this is what the effective theory is. I think a lot of people have written this down over the years. Myself, I've done it. Other people have done it. And this is what you want to do, I think, if you really want to have as much in terms of a bottom up approach, model independence, as you can probably muster. So you have this term giving mass to the W and Z, and you put in all couplings of this scalar, which is suggestively labeled H, but not assumed to be necessarily exactly a standard model Higgs, in the sense of it's not assumed to be embedded in an SU2 doublet. Put down all of its couplings, different couplings to the W and Z are in principle possible, all of its couplings to the fermions, put down a potential, and you don't just stop there, because you have higher order terms in the nonlinear chiral Lagrangian. So you have P to the fourth terms over cutoff scale squared. You also have higher order contact operators. So you have all these guys and other guys. And so there's a ton of stuff. And so the greatness of effective field theories is it's great. You can do this with the data, have a real field theoretic approach to the data that gives you a meaning when you deviate the couplings from the standard model Higgs. But it has all these parameters, right? So that's great because you get all the UV. You can embed to any UV model, almost any, but many, many UV models. But that's also the problem because the very fact that you have all these parameters which are unknown around because you don't know the UV means what are you going to do? How are you going to make progress in terms of learning from the data because you have a whole bunch of degeneracies in the fit space? It's too many parameters. So what you can do to start with is do a very simple minimalistic approach. Have that intellectual framework in mind of what the effective field theory is you're working with, but then use symmetry and the symmetry breaking structures you're putting on this effective Lagrangian to basically scale down to the number of parameters and then, that you're interested in, that we have current experimental sensitivity to. So what I think is reasonable to impose is some approximate Kosodial symmetry breaking mechanism like in the standard model, and be consistent with minimal flavor violation. So that reduces a lot of these operators. You also, practically speaking, for single Higgs production, don't need to worry about, you know, the H squareds and H cubed operators. That kills a lot. There's higher order operators in terms of P to the fourth, P to the sixth, and that the chiral Lagrangian expansion. But if you're interested in single Higgs production and decay, those will typically be set by the scale MH squared over the cutoff scale squared. So those are suppressed enough to neglect, at least for initial data analysis. And you can assume no large beyond the standard model CP violation because we don't see any evidence for it if you want. And you reduce to this sort of contact operator. So you can, with reasonable assumptions about symmetry, push yourself down to a reasonable minimal coupling space with which to examine current data, and then scale this thing up as the data set grows in precision. So that's the basic idea of what we've been doing and what's being adopted by the experiments. Yes? I still didn't hear what you said. Yeah? Well, you can treat it any way you want, but what we choose to do, okay, so in some of the results you'll see, actually I think all the results you'll see that I'll show you, we're just gonna talk in a very minimal coupling space where you just have a universal rescaling of the fermions. Now, yeah, so you can split up and down, we've done stuff like that, I'm just not gonna show anything in this talk. And you can also split off the leptons, we've done stuff like that too. Yeah. Oh yeah, I'll show you a whole bunch of invisible stuff. Yeah, but most of the stuff I'll show you is like varying one parameter at a time, because with current sensitivity, I mean, I could just show you blobs of, hey, look, everything's allowed when I vary all the parameters. It's not that interesting. So at current sensitivity, you know, one parameter at a time mostly. Yeah. So what? Right. Absolutely. Right, but the point, okay, but the point of what I'm doing, what you're about to see, is it addresses a very important physical question, and only that question, actually, which is it just a standard model of Higgs and nothing else? Right, so, I mean, that's the point, right? That's a very interesting question to ask, and so that's what we're setting up here, but as I was just about to say, but you preempted me, what you're going to see now is really addressing that question. And if you want to do other model investigations, of course you need to relax these sort of assumptions, and you'll get less precise conclusions now. But it's extremely relevant, that question of, is it just a standard model Higgs? And what's being done here is you get down to this minimal space of your deviating from the standard model. You have a well-defined field theory with which you can deviate the standard model predictions and know what the size of the corrections are. And it has a symmetry structure which is like in the standard model, but you're not assuming the standard model in the first place. And so then when you do this and you analyze the data, it allows the data to tell you if it's selecting for the standard model compared to other theories in that symmetry class. But only that. Okay? So that's, yes?
So
you're about to see it. So, well, no, because the... So I'll say a no again. And the reason is you can actually... when you assume it's in a doublet, that is actually a subclass of this theory. That just corresponds to specific choices of the Wilson coefficients. Yeah. So then that's why I say no, right? Because it's a subclass of the more general theory. Yeah, I'll also show you stuff where I assume that it is standard model Higgs and a standard model Higgs doublet. You know, you can make that choice as well. I'm not gonna say don't make that choice. What I'm saying is this analysis is what I just said before. It's to get down to something where you just have a scalar put in and it's in the symmetry class of the standard model and you wanna see if the data is really robustly selecting for that compared to alternatives. You're just in that symmetry class. And then you can also do a thing where you just assume it's a standard model Higgs from the get-go, period. And then just fit for higher dimensional operators. I'll show you that too. But the point is that is a subclass of the nonlinear realization with higher dimensional operators. All right? It's just a particular choice of a bunch of Wilson coefficients being related to one another. A lot of them are one. Higher order terms in the Carle Lagrangian expansion are zero. So it's a subset. So why not generalize in the field theoretic way to the most general thing? And then you're capturing that as well. Well, yeah, here's an example. This is coming in at dimension 5. And then you're going to get first higher order operators if it's, you're assuming it's in a doublet, dimension 6. That symmetry does a lot for you in killing off lots of terms. Yeah. But again, it's a subset of the more general case. See what I'm saying? It's a subset where you just take these dimension 5 operators, set their Wilson coefficients to 0, and the dimension 6 ones I'm not writing down here are just then taking over their job, basically, as contact operators. Okay? So we just had a long debate about this, but this was the point I was just trying to visually make, which is that the standard model is a particular point. The nonlinear realization with all higher dimensional operators is a more general formalism, and if you have the standard model, Higgs, with higher dimensional operators starting at dimension 6, like you're saying, that's a subset of this. It just corresponds to choosing a whole bunch of the operators to be 0 in the more general formalism.
Okay?
Yep.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. We're not absorbing the standard model contributions in. Okay. I know I said I'd go quick, but it's not going well. I'll try and speed up. Okay, so, oh man, I'm only on slide 11. You can't blame me, lots of questions. But okay, so look, this might be obvious, but let me just state it in case people haven't thought about this. So we have a bunch of signal strengths I showed you at the start. There's sigma times branching ratio. Just doing simple chi-squared fits, we're doing simple Gaussian stuff. I'm not going to get into all the statistics. That's really forced upon us because of a lack of information. So we do two things when we generalize this. So I've just given you the intellectual reason to think that you can generalize these couplings and have a field theoretical way of thinking about it. Practically speaking, what that means at the current time is you just do a tree-level consistent rescaling. You rescale all of the branching ratios with the dependence that they have on the standard model couplings. Put the more general couplings in and just consistently keep all that. You rescale all the production cross sections. You take the subchannel information that they give you and they break it up frequently for you, and so then you rescale each individual subchannel separately so you get that all correct. And that basically takes this and generalizes it to something that you can examine in this sort of minimal space to ask that very important question, is it just a standard model Higgs? And one thing you might worry about is that there's not just that in terms of what changes for signal strengths, there's also efficiency corrections, right? If you have some kinematic distribution and you're cutting it with experimental cuts, how do you know that when you do this that you basically get the same rough number of events going through compared to the total number of events? And you don't, you have to check. We checked a lot, and there's a simple thing you can understand, which is just basically if there's not a whole bunch of contributions coming in, if it's a smooth kinematic distribution, you're just normalizing the curve up and down. So that gives you an idea of why it wouldn't necessarily be a devastating problem. We've checked a lot of cases. Here's an example of a check where you put in the relationship between Wilson coefficients that is in the case of just a light stop, and looking at how the cross-section changes for sigma times branching ratio for gamma-gamma. So you simulate the heck out of this using all their cuts. You can see the cross-section, this mu basically changes significantly. But the efficiency correction in terms of events passing cuts is like this is, I guess you can't see, but this is percent minus percent. So it's a very small correction. So you'd worry about all these sorts of things. We've worried about them with current sensitivity. It's okay to these sort of tree-level rescalings. So I'm going to induce epilepsy and speed up by just showing you a bunch of stuff. So anyways, this is something you've seen a lot of, and experimentalists are now producing these sorts of things. But let me just explain the physics of this plot, because there is some physics to it. So this is this generalized coupling for the scalar to the W and Z. This is the generalized coupling to the fermions. Couplings come in squared as in cross sections up to constructive destructive interference. So you expect there's a degeneracy in plus minus A and plus minus C. It's exactly the case. And we've used rephasing of the Higgs field to remove the minus A solution. You have this plus minus C degeneracy that's physically distinct. This gives you constructive interference in gamma gamma. This gives you destructive. And because gamma gamma is high, that's why this sort of thing's been selected for a lot as being a preferred minimum this last year. And the tilt you get is just dictated by gamma-gamma. It's, you know, contributions of fermions in the loops versus gauge bosons in the loops. That's what indicates the tilt here. And so if you were to take the signal strength and just randomize around 1, you're going to get something that looks like this because the physics dictates it has to look like this. So it's not a surprise it looks like this. It's not a surprise it's pretty stable to look like this because it basically has to look like that if it's at all a standard model Higgs. So, okay, so hold on to your socks. So that was pre-Morion. Morion, here's how it evolved. Post-Morion, pre-IChep, not published, but just for fun. And here's day of discovery. So now these regions have gone to 1, 2, 3 sigma, because it's a discovery. There's a little bit of a challenge day of the discovery that has reemerged recently, which is that 7 and 8 TV data was not supplied independently. And the reason that's an issue is you're doing these rescalings, The parton luminosities are different at 7 and 8 TeV. The gluon fraction is different. The quark fraction is different. So if you don't want to introduce an unnecessary error, you need that information separated out. So it took us a couple days, believe it or not, to figure out that we could take 7 TeV data, 7 plus 8 TeV data, and get 8 TeV data out of it with some tricks I'll show you. But that allowed us to do this, and that's what it is, day of discovery. Yes? Oh, yeah, there's lots of ways. This thing's on its way out, right? Because it's not just in gamma-gamma that it affects. Just, do some random thing with you're doing interference. Yeah. So currently, it's not experimentally excluded. Yeah, but I think Christoph wrote a paper recently on this with some people, and I think you'll be able to exclude this probably with the full data set early next year. Just looking at interference in production, tree-level production. Exclude this other guy. Yeah.
Also, from the theoretical point of view, very different to match in a model than between your C minus 1, repeat the validity of the basic theory.
Agreed. But whether you want to a priori, get rid of that to start with or just let the data do it is, yeah. So anyways, there was a slight evolution here. 7 and 8 TV were then split by the experiments instead of us just having to split them. Things basically worked as we expected. Diphoton subcategories were released for Atlas, and WW came in, and then this became a bit preferred, mostly because WW. Okay? So that's how it's going down. That's what these plots mean. These plots, just to remind you again, are this very specific question. Is it the standard model Higgs alone, nothing else? You can go a little further, and you can also put in electric precision data in terms of this coupling. Remember, the standard model is a beautiful thing with the Higgs in it, right? It's normalizable, so there's lots of divergences that cancel off. In particular, if you look at the two-point functions for W's and Z's, there's a bunch that cancel there that no longer cancel when you generalize this coupling. So you're left with a logarithmic contribution to S and T that comes about in this generalized coupling sense. These guys calculated it, and you just put it in and use electric precision data and combine that with LHC data in a linear sense in a chi-squared space. And that's what you get. It pulls for this. It pulls for a very standard model-like mechanism of giving mass to the W and Z as you knew it had to, and that's what you end up with. So they're here, we're here, and we want to get these things to converge in time with experiment. I just really like this plot because if you think about it, this is a very expensive plot, right? All the LEP program, LHC program, and it's kind of nice that we can summarize a result like that. So I've heard rumors that some theorists sometimes do things with data that they shouldn't do. And no one in this room, I'm sure, has ever fallen for that. But in principle, that's possible. And so you might think, is this guy just full of something? So I'll show you now a bunch of checks, and because the experiments are now adopting this, of how the approximations we made, in particular one that is risable, which is we had to neglect correlations because we're not told them, doesn't seem, at least as of September, to really screw up this sort of program. It gives us an idea also that we can use the data they're giving in terms of signal strengths to learn things. And it also, this sort of cross-check will tell us in time when the experimentalists having taken over, we can't do these sorts of things and we need more information of them to learn about Higgs properties. So here's a comparison, apples to apples with CMS. So you can see we did very well. Things worked well. So we neglect correlations and they know whatever they know about correlations. So this tells you objectively that correlations don't seem to have a big impact on this particular analysis at this particular time, or they do. We set them to zero because we don't know them. CMS set some to zero they shouldn't have, and we both screwed up in the same way. But most likely that's not the case, and it just works pretty well. Here's Atlas. Sorry. Yes? I agree. I'm not saying that they're not going to matter at all. It's just a matter of, it could have been worse. That's all I'm saying. Right. It depends. Yep. I totally agree. Okay. Here's Atlas stretching out its our result to compare to their coupling analysis. So this is not exactly apples to apples. This is like a granny apple to a gala apple, because they have a slightly different WW treatment in terms of subchannels. Again, we don't have enough information to do that. But you can see it's not completely off, and they're taking it over, so that's a good thing. And also, they keep slicing up their gamma-gamma and smaller sort of things, so that obviously those correlations are going to matter. So vaya con Dios, experimental fitters. That's all I got to say. I'm glad they're taking it over. I can do other things. This is, looks exactly as you would expect for, in terms of physics reasons, as I said. This is from the Tevatron. This is a little interesting, because if you take the public Tevatron data here, and you just do this to check, you'll see this. Now, this is a different scale, so it's not as bad as it looks initially. But this sort of indicates, this is just kind of a proxy test to us, for us to know, can we just take these signal strengths and draw broad physics conclusions from them, just in how our models affect Higgs properties? And so at some point, the correlations and other information will need other information. So for example, to use the Tevatron, it seems like we need another set of information to actually be able to draw conclusions from their signal strengths. And that will happen eventually at Atlas and CMS. So I think we as a community need to basically come to an agreement on what information we need in terms of Higgs properties, so we can do our studies and unplug the experimentalists to run every particular fit that we want to run. So here's some other things you can do. So I motivated this sort of AC fit space thing, looking for just the standard model hypothesis. You can do the same thing where you only keep the higher dimensional operators. Okay? And that's really interesting, because if you do that, the standard model emerges from the data more easily. So that doesn't mean anything now statistically, I don't think. But as time goes on, comparing this sort of analysis with the previous analysis could be some indirect hint that there's some other states around inducing these loop corrections that are actually letting the standard model be there in the context of new physics. It's an interesting thing. You can also go in terms of marginalizing over the tree-level couplings and just looking at robust information about higher dimensional operators. This twiddles because I've taken out the 16 pi squared. So you can really think of these in terms of quantum numbers. And ask the question, is there any, you know, robust evidence for a gamma-gamma contact operator to enhance gamma-gamma? There isn't. You can just accommodate it with the experimental uncertainty on these couplings. So we need more data in both cases, but these are the sorts of ways that if you want to use the data to try and draw, you know, higher and higher scale conclusions, you want to keep these things in mind so you don't get led in the wrong direction. And, you know, we realize what assumptions you're making when you're following the data. So I've got to speed up. So here, I'll just show you some equations which are nice equations. They can let you play with the data in lots of different ways. So as well as just doing a simple fit, you can do you can build your own PDFs. If you assume Gaussian information, you neglect correlations because you have to anyways. And PDFs, right, they're just, you know, Gaussian distributions. You assume that it's distributed around a central value with some error. And you can then multiply such PDFs together, and you get back PDFs. And these are nice equations to remember, which is just, if you do that, you get a combined combined Gaussian, which is related to the individual Gaussians this way, and a central value related to the individual central values this way. So you can use those to play around with sigma strengths. And you can use this sort of approach to define a global PDF. Again, I'm neglecting correlations here because I have to. But you can do this to basically define a global PDF as a function of these unknown parameters, and then compare it to data. And in the space of these couplings, you'll have regions where you just globally get too few events, globally get too many events. And you can also look at consistency within data sets. So this is a region, and you can see how it's complementary to doing a fit, where there's just too few events in that sense, from a global PDF, 95% confidence level. The other region is too many, and this is when you have inconsistencies driven within the data set at the level at least 2 sigma. So this can kill individual models that might not be killed directly just by a global analysis. For example, fermiophobia is like an idea of models along this line, and so it's in trouble with particular measurements. And so you can just do other things other than just fitting the data. So one thing you can do is invisible branching ratios. It's the simplest thing you can do because it's just one parameter. And it's the one parameter that affects things universally. Okay? So it shifts all the signal strengths at the same time if you don't also assume that there's like some other state inducing glu-glu H. So this is the simplest thing. Just assume it's a standard model, put in an invisible width, that's it. And it's kind of nice because it lets you play some games. So you use these formulas again, because you're neglecting correlations. And you learn, it's just trivial, that the invisible branching ratio is 1 minus the combined signal strengths reported by the experiment. Okay? So what's nice about this is you can then take the combined signal strengths reported by the experiment, which whatever they know about correlations, which is not public, they use to build their combined signal strength, and you can look at the data and slice it up different ways. And again, sanity check, is neglecting correlations at all okay with this level of precision? So here's a comparison of using CMS data where we do that. We just have an invisible branch ratio fit to the global combined signal strength and compare to fitting the data individually, putting individual signal strengths having this invisible branching ratio and compare, and you can see it doesn't, again, screamingly tell you that neglecting correlations at that level of precision as of September is a total screw-up. Here's the current data, because it's so trivial to do, I can subtract for you on the weekend, so I did. And here's CMS only with its recent combined signal strength at 125. You can see because it has a fluctuation down, of course, a central value here, it doesn't mean anything statistically, 95% confidence level limit on its invisible branching ratio. All data is this. And there's no evidence of an invisible branching ratio emerging as yet, statistically speaking. So these are just basically the inversion of the combined signal strength plots from the experiments. So again, I just subtracted. I'll do it for you. And the point is that you also need to be able to distinguish in this very simple scenario from just a global fluctuation of the background or a global fluctuation of all the signal strengths. So if you want to have at least 2 sigma evidence of actually finding evidence for an invisible branching ratio, there's nothing like that showing up yet. But if you want to have at least 2 sigma evidence of that, you'd have to sit in these regions which distinguish the background fluctuation and the global fluctuation on the signal. And you can see that we're not there at all, so we can't really conclude anything. So there's no smoking gun for dark matter at all. But I just want to make the point, there's a lot of papers written on searching for invisible branching ratios with particular kinematic signatures. And that's all well and good. But of course, if you're not invoking a complicated scenario where you have lots of different states so that you this sort of a simple approximation is at least reasonable in terms of how the data would be affected, the first way I think would emerge from the data, if there was an invisible branching ratio, would be a global property shift, right? It would just be a global effect on all of the signal strengths. So that just tells you why when you're combining all these signal strengths, it's a very powerful way to search for this. Probably the leading indication. So here's a case where if you just assume it's a standard model Higgs and only write down higher dimensional operators, what do you get? Now this, if you haven't looked at this sort of thing, this is a wonderful thing. This is what you got with 7TV data, just fitting for the effect on glu-glu Higgs and gamma-gamma Higgs, shifting, combining these guys to just getting a gamma-gamma Higgs. And you can just see how these things have scaled. The scale's changed here as well. For the September data compared to the 7TV data. So it's just resolving information about the properties of the production decay of the Higgs in an amazing way. The experimentalists are really doing an amazing job. And when you see this sort of thing, it's just wonderful to see. And so what you can do, what is a reasonable thing to do, is if this sort of thing firms up over time, more and more data comes in, this sort of thing firms up, and you're pretty sure it's a standard model Higgs, so you're okay with the starting point, you don't care about this nonlinear realization crap, you just want to have a standard model Higgs, then you can just look at this space and you can think about fields when you integrate them out, give you these Wilson coefficients and these Wilson coefficients, right? If it's a one loop matching in both cases, the representations of the field would basically dictate a line in this space. It'll just be dictated by the quantum numbers and there'll be some line which will correspond to your field and you can say, well, does my field go right through the central region or not? And if there were interesting popular fields that did, it would be exciting. So there are interesting fields that do go through that region, although I don't think you should get too excited yet. I think it's a nice observation. So this is something tons of people have done. So I'm not going to say anything other than we've done it too, in terms of shifting the glu-glu Higgs and the gamma-gamma Higgs just because of stops. So you can think of this in terms of natural SUSY if you want. This isn't some complete spectrum like other people do. It's just a simple effective stops, including the QCD squark matching correction at least. It's a 10% sort of effect. And just doing an effective field theory analysis on it, that's how it shifts the operators. Here's the matching corrections and the no mixing limit. The mixing being incorporated is a correction on this correction, so it's pretty small. And you'd get, as I said, a predictive relationship between the Wilson coefficients and with the QCD corrections just given there. So that's a line in this space, which does that. Interesting. Unfortunately, I'm not going to say this whole region is ruled out because you have lots of parameters, lots of different kinematic signatures, but this does correspond, as you'll see in a moment, to very, very light stops. So I think there would be any caution, due caution should be observed in interpreting this. But it is interesting that it goes through the best fit region. I told you you can do exclusions as well. This is an exclusion region for too few events and too many events. Kind of looks like a snake with its head cut off. And I'll show you both. So here's the translation into the stop space. You can see this is the best fit region I told you about, very light, lightest stop eigenstate, and then a much heavier second eigenstate. You need maximal mixing, basically. This is minimal mixing, zero mixing, intermediate mixing, which is pi over 12, and then pi over 4 here. And you know, you just need a negative sign here to get this thing to be positive. That's what we kind of knew was the case.
Yep. Sort of analysis, are you using any constraint on the Higgs mass?
No. That's right. Yeah. So we're just putting in just the effect of the stop in terms of the Wilson coefficients. If you were to try and accommodate the mass, you'd be in much bigger trouble. It's much harder for it to do with the data. So, yeah, should have said that, but that's true. So this was what I said goes through the best fit region. This is just a decoupling solution. It's just this second region. So you either live dangerously up here where you have very light stops, or you live off decoupling. And then, you know, things are much more massive. So I just mean whether it intersects in the fit space down here or intersects up here. This is the decoupling region because the effects are going to zero. Got it? You still look confused, though. Oh, you can't quite see the plot? Sorry, this is the C gamma with the 16 pi squared taken out again, the CG with 16 pi squared taken out. So decoupling would be 0, 0 in these Wilson coefficients, right? Okay, anyways. But there is some challenges, even if you don't try and get the Higgs mass, there is some challenges in terms of consistency with things like beta S gamma. That selects for very degenerate stops, even in this minimal scenario. There's a Targino contribution here, so you have to choose that. So this is 100 for mu and 200 GV for mu. But you can see it pulls for a more degenerate case. So there's obviously some tension in the data.
Okay, when
people
gamma, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's just in this more minimal spectrum I'm talking about. It's not a full spectrum. I totally agree it's not a full spectrum. All I'm saying is that within this minimal spectrum where you might gain some joy and excitement out of the fact that it works pretty well with the Higgs data, the same spectrum doesn't work so well for beta scam. That's all I'm saying. Well, it's for the minimal spectrum, I can look at both. Okay. So anyways, for that minimal spectrum, one can build an exclusion because of that tension, but only for that. And that's what I'm showing here. This is a. So it's just motivated of this natural SUSY idea. So basically, it's just you just basically have a low tan beta scenario, light stops, and you are neglecting spottom effects, and you have some light Chargino around, dictated by the new parameter, heavy gauginos, very minimal. You can dictate it by naturalness if you want.
But again, the Higgs mass is not explained at all.
It is not. It's not. That would make it even worse. That would make it even worse. Yes. Yeah, so you'd have to have some sort of mechanism of raising the Higgs mass, which I'm not going to get into. I'm just, look, we're just doing minimal stuff here, right? Just one field contributing to Wilson coefficients and saying how well does it work, and then comparing for beta S gamma. That's all we're doing. It's not a full spectrum, full explanation of everything. I leave that to other people.
Well,
if you wish. But it has the representation of a supersymmetric top. You can choose to call it what you wish. I'm just telling you what I did, and that's it. So the point is, though, this sort of minimal thing in sort of a minimal non-complete spectrum is able, you can build an exclusion if you look at beta S gamma and compare to the Higgs data, because they pull for different directions. And when you do that, it just illustrates to you that the Higgs data is very complementary in terms of direct collider searches, because it doesn't really care about going to large Targino masses. Neutralino masses, sorry. It's the loop effects of just the stop is all that it cares about. And so that's why it's complementary in this space. Now again, don't overinterpret this space. These different studies have different assumptions about spectra too. So don't think that when this is all colored in, SUSY is included. It's not. But just it just tells you that it's complementary information to direct collider searches. So ATLAS is going to do a study of this form to try and get exclusions for these very particular specific assumptions. and that's it. But interpret with caution. So that's it. I'll just stop there. Any more questions?
Carlos. I have a question, so regarding the nice talk. Forget the pitch must constantly.
Yeah.
Usually when you have nice talks and you put perhaps mixing, you tend to suppress more of the non-fusion than you tend to enhance the amalgam. So the suppression of the non-fusion tends to overwhelm you.
Yeah, so it is. That's what's happening here. You're suppressing gluon fusion, but you're enhancing gamma-gamma enough that in a global perspective, you can fit the data. Although if you were to just look at it. Yeah?
The overall effect tends to be a suppression of the gluon fusion
gamma. It's but not for all parameter spaces. So, yeah. So you're living dangerously.
Where was the suppression so big, so minus twice somehow?
So large.
It's very, very large mixing.
Ah, very well. That could cause instability.
It could, indeed. Yeah. Yeah. So I would be very cautious about being excited that it goes through that region. I think you basically have to live on the decoupling region. Sorry. It's consistent in that in the very specific test I showed you, it's been consistent at the start of the year at 2 sigma, and it's basically stayed at 2 sigma, and the experimentalists are still saying 2 sigma. But that, again, is a very specific way of asking the question. But at least you can answer it at least that way.
Right.